Hello, hello, hello. This is Henry Rollins, and you are listening to KORC 105.9 LPFM, servicing Corvallis, Oregon, streaming worldwide at KORCFM.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
It's time for a KORC Geo Report. About 45 miles north of Corvallis on the western foothills of the Coast Range, a boulder the size of an automobile rests on a grassy knoll overlooking the Willamette Valley. These days it's called the Sheridan Erratic, and it sits within Erratic Rock State Park. It may sound like just a rock, but it also may surprise you that this rock came here from the northern Rocky Mountains in present-day Montana around 15,000 years ago. That makes it much older than the volcanic rocks and marine sandstones of the Oregon Coast Range and Willamette Valley. Almost 1.5 billion years older, in fact. This rock was formed when the most complex life forms on planet Earth were layered mats of photosynthetic bacterial colonies. In fact, there are almost 400 known rocks of a similar origin recorded in the Willamette Valley. Okay, so how did these traveling rocks end up in our backyard? There are several ways we can explain this, and one is with the study of geomorphology. That basically means the study of landforms. By studying the physical processes that create and shape landforms over geologic time, we can understand why the surface of our landscape looks the way it does. One way that large boulders end up at the top of a hill is from being carried there by water or ice. And that is exactly what happened in this case. This rock floated here, stuck in a raft of ice, which traveled hundreds of miles during the Missoula mega floods of the last ice age. Beginning with geologic investigations by Harlan Bretz in the early 20th century, Earth scientists have come to learn that about 15,000 years ago, during the late Pleistocene epoch, a natural barrier made of ice formed a massive lake of glacial meltwater in the Missoula Valley in present-day Montana. When this ice dam broke, a torrent of water, the likes of which have never been seen in modern human history, was unleashed, ripping through the ancient Columbia Basin. The flood scoured its way through what are now the channeled scablands and coulees of Washington State, and carved out the Columbia Gorge with such catastrophic force that it's possible the torrent could have been heard coming for hours or days before it actually arrived. Recent geophysical estimates place the flood's flow rate at 10 times the flow of all current rivers combined. Now, among scientists, catastrophism of the biblical variety was already an antiquated strain of thought, since geologists had begun embracing the model of gradual geologic change for almost 100 years already. So it took a few decades of research to confirm Bretz's unusual hypothesis. Piecing together the evidence of megafloods involved identifying and dating massive erosional features in the Columbia River basalts, which could not be explained by the region's hydrology. There are also remnants of sediment carried by the flood waters and deposited, which can be pieced together across the landscape. This stratigraphic record shows that they happened at least 40 times between roughly 15,000 and 13,000 years ago. Later analyses of the Sheridan Erratic and other boulders yielded geochemical signatures of the bedrock around the Missoula Valley. Samples of flood sediments matched topsoil and basalt bedrock scoured from the Columbia Basin, including samples from the Willamette Valley. So if you've been wondering more about how this relates to our region, well, it turns out that these floodwaters hit a natural choke point at the Kalama Gap, northwest of present-day Portland, backing up mega floodwaters into the ancient Willamette Valley to a height of almost 400 feet. That means that all of present-day Corvallis would be submerged, with the top of Bald Hill exposed and waters backing up the Marys River past Philomath into the western foothills. Geologists call this Lake Allison, and massive gravel deltas were deposited near Portland and Salem, and as waters receded, dirty ice rafts were stranded and dropped the boulders we see today, and a thick layer of silt and clay blanketed almost the entire Willamette Valley. This changed the character of the river forever, turning the valley into a prairie with a sluggish, meandering stream, and it created the fertile soils that so attracted Euro-American settlers in the 19th century and continues to feed us today. At this point, I must point out that the scientists of the last century neglected to pursue another form of evidence for the mega floods, which didn't fit into their understanding of science at the time. And that is the oral history of people known as the Kalapuya, who may well have been living in the Willamette Valley during at least some of these flood events. For many of the local descendants of the Kalapuya and other groups who have inhabited this region for many thousands of years, the stories they carry from their ancestors record the history of the people and the land. Dr. David Lewis, a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, says in his Quartux, Journal of Critical Indigenous Perspectives, that at least two Kalapuya origin stories address a flood. One story goes like this, and Dr. Lewis reminds us that native oral histories don't always proceed in a linear manner, even while they provide meaning and causality to the events in them. A man cut the two braids of a woman's hair, and he gave it to a small chicken hawk. Now Coyote's child, he removed from her womb, and he threw it into the stream. And now the man leapt ashore, and all the people went away. Now the waters came up, and some of the people, the large birds, carried them up on their backs. They took them to a big mountain, Mary's Peak. All those people went to that big mountain. Now the water was coming up higher. All the country was filled with water. Then Skunk took an oak puffball, also known as a gall, and he made a hole in the gall, and he got inside that, and to be sure that the oak puffball floated on top of the water. Now all the people were running along, and they climbed up a big mountain, and it was on that one very loftiest mountain that all these people got up, and the copperhead snake was carrying the fire along with him as he swam. Now the water got pretty nearly to the top of the mountain, and the people said to Panther, also known as Cougar Mountain Lion, "What have you taken? This water does not want to go back." And he said, "I took nothing. I took only my child, and I took that woman's hair." And the people said, "Oh, throw away that hair of hers. Maybe it is that which the water is pursuing." And so Panther told Small Chicken Hawk, "Throw that hair into the water." Sure enough, Small Chicken Hawk threw that hair into the water, and sure enough, the water went down. And the people said, "What shall we do now? There's no fire." And Copperhead Snake said, "Don't worry, I put the fire right here." Regarding the mention of the woman's hair, Dr. Lewis says, quote, "Throw away that hair of hers, maybe it is that which the water is pursuing," suggests that the people were confused as to why the floods came to the valley. They were seeking for a reason, a causality, and found it in the woman's hair. Hair for native people has a lot of power. Hair carries our history as it grows longer each day and thus experiences all of the same things as we do. Therefore, cutting one's long hair suggests we are getting rid of our history or letting go of the past so that we can move forward. Does the hair of the story suggest that people were accepting that they had gone into mourning to let go of the past? Of all the people and animal people killed by the floods, and accept the rebirth of the land and the changes that came with the events? So rather than the cause of the flood, perhaps it is more acceptance of the need to move on. These suggestions are mine alone, based on Jacob's English translations." Unquote. It's true that many cultures who live in or near floodplains have stories about big floods. However, it's important to incorporate traditional indigenous knowledge into a holistic understanding of the past and the land we live on together, the rejection of which is to continue the attempted erasure of people whose countless generations of ancestors lived here before the American Empire. Even from an empirical standpoint, it's notable that many oral histories across formerly glaciated regions of North America seem to record significant environmental changes that could be associated with the truly life-altering climate change that occurred during this time across the continent. Barretts didn't know it at the time, but from recent investigations at Paisley Rock Shelter, we now know that humans thrived in the Summer Lake Basin, about 150 miles to the southeast of the Willamette Valley, over 14,000 years ago, while the Cooper's Ferry site in western Idaho has been dated to 15,700 years before present. Emerging models of coastal migration around the Pacific Rim from Asia are helping to explain how archaeological sites continue to predate the apparent opening of an ice-free corridor in what is now the Bering Strait. So it's both historically and empirically plausible that Kalapuni ancestors witnessed the Missoula mega floods which shaped the Willamette Valley forever. While millennia of erosive forces have reshaped much of the valley floor and walls, you can still see the record of this prehistoric cataclysm here in our region in the form of the Sheridan erratic and other boulders. In deep cut banks such as those exposed at Irish Bend, the silts and clays of the mega floods can still be seen and touched. And of course, our rich soils still support life as we know it in the Willamette Valley.
The following is an encore presentation of an interview with Dr. Suzanne Brander. This interview initially aired on the program on September 29th and 30th. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. This is Dan Kral. And as I record this, I am at the corner of Jefferson and 4th Street in downtown Corvallis, just outside the Coffee Culture Coffee House. As I look to the western sky, well, as I record this anyway, it still looks like a beautiful summer day. We are experiencing less days to when we can line dry our clothing with this beautiful Oregon sun. I know that I personally care very much about my environmental impact and everything from laundry to transportation. I try to be very mindful. And part of why I really love drying clothes on the line is because it's just less natural gas being used. And I also try to be very mindful of the microfibers in my clothing. And just as I was thinking about this more, I came across some articles about how there's very important research in microfibers going on right now. I'm not the only person thinking about this. In fact, I'm joined right now by Dr. Suzanne Brander, who is an associate professor at Oregon State University in the College of Agricultural Sciences. And thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
From what I understand, you're doing all kinds of important research in this very topic, microfibers in clothing.
Yeah, so myself and collaborators, both at Oregon State University and Portland State University as well, are doing studies kind of ranging from the impacts of microfibers in the environment on aquatic organisms, as well as occurrence in different types of ecosystems. And then we're also looking at how we can reduce the amount of fibers that are getting back out into the environment from our laundry and other household tasks.
In this day and age, clothing is made from all sorts of different fibers, not all of which are natural. We've got polyesters and a lot of petroleum-based products in our clothing. It seems every load of laundry, it's something to consider that as we're flushing this water out that we just used to wash our clothes, there's all kinds of leftover microplastics.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. Polyester is one of the most popular textile types. And in addition to that being a really popular textile to make clothing from because it's inexpensive, it's comfortable to wear if you're exercising in it, it's moisture wicking. All of these things are great in terms of how useful the fabric is, but unfortunately, every time we do a load of laundry, on average, you generate about 9 million microfibers from that one load. And if you're not filtering your washing machine gray water, that's going right back out to a wastewater treatment plant, which isn't necessarily going to have the technology to filter those fibers out of the water or out of the sludge before that gets either discharged back into a waterway or applied to an agricultural field.
So I know that I live in South Corvallis, and our water goes to the wastewater treatment plant that is along the Willamette River. So along with wastewater and sludge and all that that gets treated, do they just then discharge these microplastics into the river?
Yeah, there really isn't a good way to remove microplastics and microfibers from wastewater, at least not as it currently stands. There are proposed technologies, but those would be a huge investment in terms of, you know, redesigning most wastewater treatment plants in the United States and elsewhere globally. And so wastewater treatment plants are designed to disinfect and sterilize, but they're not designed to remove particles in an efficient way.
For those of us who maybe buy a lot of our clothing used, or nowadays you can buy recycled cotton and organic cotton, industrial hemp is making its way back on the scene after many years of being illegal in many states. So there are solutions as to what they're composing the clothes from, but what can the average person do with this in mind, that the microplastics from every load of laundry is a factor?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'll talk a little bit about what consumers can do, but also what's happening at a larger level. So we're hoping that in the future, the responsibility isn't all on the consumer side and the downstream side here. What buying clothing secondhand is a great way to reduce your impact. Even if you're still generating microfibers from your laundry, you are working at the other side, the upstream side of the solution, and you are buying fewer textiles. I mean, a really big issue right now is that the average person buys over 50 items of clothing per year because clothing has become so much less expensive because we don't factor in all of these environmental costs and the costs of cheap labor as well, which has a whole other set of bad side effects. But things that you can do are, like I said, buy secondhand clothing. Try to focus on buying things that are made out of natural fibers. If you can get organic cotton secondhand, you know, for your clothing items, that's fantastic. Cotton breaks down more quickly than plastics do. It still gets out there, and we still find it in the fish and sediments and water that we sample, but it's less harmful than polyester or polypropylene or nylon, other synthetic fabrics that are going to persist for longer and can cause more environmental damage. You can wash your clothes with cold water. Line drying was mentioned. I mean, it's not just washing machines, it's also dryers. Most dryers in North America vent out the side of people's homes, and so there's research showing that that might actually generate more microfibers than washing your clothing does. So line drying, washing in cold water, just washing less if you can. I mean, maybe you don't need to wash your jeans after every time you wear them. There's been recommendations like that made. But really what's happening at more of a global and national level, there is a global treaty being negotiated right now that would, if passed, would have binding measures in place to try to reduce how much we're making. And that's really one of the biggest problems, just the production side. We're producing so many items of clothing that we don't necessarily need to even be producing. So putting controls on that. And then at the federal level, Mark Merkley, our senator from Oregon, has even proposed requiring filters on washing machines that are made after a certain year. And that's something that's also been proposed by the state of Oregon and the state of California, too. Those bills just haven't passed yet. So there's work happening from a legislative side, too.
What is the name of this treaty?
So it's the Global Treaty for Plastic Pollution. It's being negotiated by the United Nations Environment Program, and they have been having negotiating meetings since the end of 2022 on this treaty. It turns out it takes a really long time to get 170 countries to agree on something, and so they're having their fifth negotiating session at the end of November of this year, and that's supposed to be the final one. And so it'll be interesting to see how many countries sign on to it, if it actually goes forward. But it's really encouraging to see that just after about roughly 2 to maybe 2.5 decades of research on microplastics and microfibers, that action is happening at a global level to try to address this challenge.
And I know that as an American, I am continually frustrated by some of the treaties and agreements that our country doesn't sign on to. It's no secret that our government is all but run by lobbyists, and like the American Plastics Council, DuPont, a lot of these companies that have had influence for a long time have really affected legislation, and not to mention the public attitude toward conserving the environment. It seems that just within the last 50 years, we went from being a society that at least cared a little bit about the environment, or at least from a personal responsibility level, it seemed a lot more people were aware of conservation, whereas now, it's not to say nobody's paying attention, it's just between the growth of population and all the products on the market, the lobbying influence in our government, sometimes as an American, it can feel very frustrating to not be on the right page with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I would say that in terms of the treaty, it's been encouraging to see that the United States has not yet backed down from some of the more ambitious goals. And where they aren't saying a lot necessarily, they aren't saying no at this point to some of the more ambitious objectives of the treaty. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. But yeah, it's a huge challenge. And I also think that so much of the responsibility has been placed on consumers who aren't even, they don't have access to the materials or education that they would need to make the right choices. And it's hard to make the right choices. You go grocery shopping or you go shopping for clothing, and it's really difficult to tell what's environmentally friendly, what isn't. You could have one cotton garment that is organic and is going to produce less of an impact overall, but you might have another cotton garment that looks the same, that's been treated with a bunch of pesticides. And sometimes a lot of these different textiles are mixed together. So I think I've done some surveys of audiences when I've talked about microfibers, and almost every single time, the majority of the people are wearing a t-shirt that is 60% polyester, 40% cotton. So we do a lot of this blending that makes it challenging to make the right choices, too. So really, ideally, this is going to be a problem that we tackle upstream as well as downstream, because we can't put all of the responsibility on people who don't have access to the right tools to make good decisions.
We're speaking with Dr. Suzanne Brander, who is an associate professor at Oregon State University at the College of Agricultural Sciences. We are talking about microfibers in clothing, and Dr. Brander has done some recent research, collaborations on some very well-researched papers. So if listeners would like to see some of your body of research, maybe a website where they can find more items on microfiber awareness, do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a collaboration with another faculty member at Oregon State, Dr. Stacy Harper, who specializes in nanomaterials and nanoplastics. And we co-lead the Pacific Northwest Consortium on Plastics. That is a group of almost 300 members. We've been in place since 2019. So we have a website that's pnwmicroplastics.org. And then you can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Twitter, or I guess it's called X now, as well as LinkedIn. And that would be the best place to get updates on work that's happening in this area specific to our labs at OSU.
And while we are coming to the end of line drying season, at least on a daily basis, there are some sunny days that we're going to see throughout the fall and winter where maybe folks who haven't given it a chance to line dry, where they've got good southern exposure in the yard. I love line drying. Do you line dry?
I do when I can. I have two kids who play soccer and do all sorts of other things, and so sometimes it doesn't work out, but when I can, I do, and I encourage that. And also, I'm even looking into, apparently in Europe, they use these heat pump dryers that don't vent to the outside of your home. And I'm looking into even maybe getting one of those because you wouldn't have that problem of just spewing microfibers out of the side of your house every time you dry your clothes. So
if you look at the lint catcher inside of your dryer, I mean, that just gives you an idea of what's going out into the environment. And that's just one household.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a project we've had in the past 5 or so years. We do a lot of work where we look at occurrence of microplastics and fibers in the environment. And for almost every project we've done, sampling fish or other types of samples off the Oregon coast, the majority of what we find are microfibers. They're not necessarily all plastic. Some of them are cotton, but cotton can be made more persistent by chemical treatment. But that's really most of what we find in fish guts, fish fillets, so they can even kind of move around inside the body if they're small enough. So really, that whatever we can do to keep them out of the environment, the better.
Well, we only have one planet. Living in the modern world, it's not always the easiest to be perfect. And luckily, nobody's asking you to be perfect. It's just good to be aware of these things and sometimes make better consumption decisions. It's all connected.
And also voting to support politicians who are supportive of the right environmental goals is makes a huge difference and will have a huge impact as well.
Well said. Well, I want to thank you again for your time today. We have been speaking with Dr. Suzanne Brander, an associate professor at OSU in the College of Ag Sciences, who is doing important research about microfibers in the clothing. If you can give the website of your group one more time for the listeners.
Sure. So it's www.pnwmicroplastics.org.
All right. I'd like to thank you again for your time today.
Thank you so much. I'm glad we had a sunny day, too. One more left.
Right. Yeah. Yes, as we do record this, it is midweek in late September. And you are listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, which is heard Sundays from 1 to 2. We repeat the program Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., and the program is archived at korcfm.com. Just go there and click on News. And if you and the listening audience would like to offer some news tips, maybe your thoughts on microfibers, send us an email, info@korcfm.com. The global consumption of synthetic fibers increased from a few thousand tons in 1940 to more than 60 million tons in 2018, and it continues to rise. Fibers are shed throughout the whole life cycle of textile products, from manufacturing to use, such as laundry, drying, and wearing, as well as disposal. Microfibers readily disperse via water and air due to their lightweight nature, and they are transported across large distances. Microfibers from textiles are a key source of human-caused particles to air, soil, food, and water. Fibers can translocate from an organism's gut to other tissues and may be more difficult to excrete. Studies suggest that fibers may cause higher toxicity in comparison to other microplastics. Substantial quantities of microfibers enter the environment through the application of sewage biosolid, leading to the potential for localized accumulation in soil and effects on terrestrial organisms. Prioritizing upstream interventions at the textile production level will be the most effective in achieving an overall reduction of microfiber emissions. This comes from a working paper entitled Microfibers from Textiles, a Key Source of Microplastics to the Environment, Fate, Effects, and Mitigation Strategies. As of September 2024, this working paper was prepared independently by members of the Scientists' Coalition for an Effective Plastics Treaty. We spoke earlier with Dr. Suzanne Brander of Oregon State University, who is contributing to this research. You can find this paper at ikhapp.org. That's ikhapp.org. The name of the paper is Microfibers from Textiles, a Key Source of Microplastics to the Environment, Fate, Effects, and Mitigation Strategies. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. Michael Moore has accurately predicted the last four presidential elections and has made his prediction for this contentious national election in November. His predictions are based on the following information, dated October 4th. Listeners understand that his perspective comes from the state of Michigan, where he is from and currently lives, as will be heard later in this explanation. His commentary is as follows. Right now, if you know how to really read the polls, or if you have access to the various private and internal polling being conducted by and shared only amongst the elites, Wall Street, and members of Congress, then you already know that this election was over weeks ago. Trump refused to believe that quote-unquote Sleepy Joe was no longer his opponent, and that there was instead, quote-unquote, some woman claiming that she was, quote-unquote, black, who was now going to pummel him on Election Day. An aggregate of top polls as of today, October 4th, shows that Harris will defeat Trump in the Electoral College count by 270 to 268. Michael predicts the following scenarios. Harris will win six states west of the Rockies: Colorado, New Mexico, California, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii. Harris will also win six of the eight Great Lakes states: Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and New York. And Harris will win the District of Columbia and the 10 New England and Atlantic states from the Canadian border to Virginia, including Virginia, Maryland, D.C., Delaware, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine. So right now, the crystal ball brings the Harris and Trump totals to Harris at 270 electoral votes and Trump to 268 electoral votes. Michael adds, "You and I know that there's always ways for him to win. We do know that Trump has a stellar streak of pulling off the impossible, and those who have written him off have more than once lived to see the day where they must eat humble pie." So Michael poses three scenarios. First, if Trump does win Michigan, Harris can overcome that by winning either Georgia or North Carolina. That's all she'll need. Or, if Harris can't pull that off, she can still lose Michigan and be the new president by winning Arizona and Nevada. One little hiccup. When Biden and Harris won Michigan in 2020, they did so with a whopping 66% of the Arab and Muslim vote, more than double what Trump got. But polls in Michigan since last October have shown that the vast majority of Biden's Arab voters decided not to vote for his ticket come this November due to his funding and arming of Netanyahu's slaughter of the people in Gaza. By summer, I thought President Biden would have stopped this. That did not happen. And to this day, Biden has refused to demand that those to whom we give our bombs and our billions in Israel must follow our laws and refrain from committing war crimes. What Biden did do that may save the vote in Michigan was to stop running for president and instead turn the reins over to his vice president, who has been pushing for a ceasefire and a compliance to our American values of human rights and not killing civilians, and an end to the war in Gaza. She supported protecting the lives of Israelis, but she was not going to stand for the use of mass starvation as a weapon of war. It appears that she felt strongly about this. So much so that when Netanyahu came to address a joint session of Congress with a speech full of vitriol and out-of-control condemnation of the youth of America, who had organized mass protests against the country to stop the genocide, she refused to attend his speech and thus not sit with him on the platform. He was appalled, and the next day he made a beeline to Mar-a-Lago to commiserate with Trump. There are those who understand the symbolism of what happened that week and, like me, hold out a profound hope that the U.S. policy regarding Israel-Palestine will soon be better. One sign of that is from two new polls in Michigan, which show that Harris's chances may now have improved over Biden's with the Arab American community. But not all the way. She is still 18 points behind the vote they both received in Michigan in 2020. Do we really need Michigan to win in November? Since World War II, the last Democrat who won the White House while losing the state of Michigan was no one, with the exception for the one and only president in all of history who was actually from Michigan, Gerald Ford. As Michelle Goldberg from the New York Times wrote, quote, "If you lose Michigan, you lose the White House," unquote. Second scenario, if Trump wins Pennsylvania, then Harris must win either Georgia or North Carolina, plus either Nevada or Arizona. Third scenario and final scenario, if Trump wins Michigan and Pennsylvania, Harris can still beat him by winning Georgia, North Carolina, and either Nevada or Arizona. To repeat, this was a commentary from Michael Moore, dated October 4th, who has accurately predicted the last four national election victories. This has been aired with permission by Michael Moore. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
Wintertime is often a time of stagnant air here in the Willamette Valley. This contributes to increased air pollution and decreased air quality throughout the valley. You can help reduce air pollution by doing one simple thing. Turn off your car or truck motor when waiting in your car for more than 20 seconds. Car and truck idling emits many toxic chemicals like benzene, carbon monoxide, and other pollutants into the air. Idling is a major source of Oregon's excessively high levels of benzene, which is a cancer-causing pollutant linked with childhood leukemia. Not idling your motor also helps tackle climate change. Gas engine idling accounts for over 93 million tons of CO2 and over 10 billion wasted gallons of gasoline a year. Do your part. No one's asking you to be perfect. Just be aware of these things. Don't leave the vehicle idling. This message has been brought to you by KORC.
Hey, this is Phil Farrell with KORC, and you're listening to the Civics and News segment, heard every Sunday at 1 p.m. Now, I've been thinking about doing some history stories, so I was looking up to see what historical events took place in Corvallis in the month of October, and it seems like a very important event happened in this month. In October of 1845, the first non-native or white settler, Joseph C. Avery, all the way from Pennsylvania, arrived in the area that would become Corvallis. But before Joseph Avery and other settlers came to this area, there was already people living here. These natives were called the Kalapuyas, and they were native to this area and much of Willamette Valley and much of western Oregon. Now, the Kalapuya were made up of similar but separate tribes, and the tribe native to this specific area in Corvallis were known as the Mary's River Tribe, named after the river that flows through the area. The Kalapuya were known for living off the land, gathering local fruit, such as berries, nuts, such as hazelnuts and acorns, and other edible plants, such as lily bulbs, and many others. They were also known to hunt the wildlife on land and fish the aquatic wildlife as well. The Kalapuyas were known for making jewelry from shells and were worn to show status and wealth, and were also used as a form of currency. The grass fields in the area were not natural and were created and maintained by the Kalapuyas through annual field burnings. Now, by the time Joseph Avery arrived into the area that would become Corvallis in 1845, 90% of the Kalapuya population had already been taken out due to malaria. This disease was introduced through European settlers, mostly through the fur trade in the 1800s. So with most of the native Kalapuya population gone, I guess you could literally say the land was for the taking. And in 1850, a federal statute was passed called the Oregon Donation Land Act, allowing white and partial Native American and white settlers to work for 4 years and legally claim land. Through this act, 7,437 land patents were granted. And in 1855, the Kalapuya Treaty was signed, taking the roughly 400 remaining Kalapuya tribe members in the area and moving them to the Grand Ronde Reservation. Now, the city of Corvallis was originally named Marysville, named after the proximity to Mary's Peak. The name was later changed to Corvallis, which in Latin can translate to Heart of the Valley. Now, in 1855, Corvallis was briefly the capital of the territory, where the first passed legislature was to move it back to Salem. In 1857, it became a seat for Benton County government. In 1968, legislature established the Corvallis College, originally owned by the Methodist Episcopal Church. This would eventually become Oregon State University. And in 1885, the state took control of the agricultural college. With regular steamboat traffic up and down the Willamette River, more people were able to enter Corvallis, and more goods were exported. By the late 1800s, Corvallis became an agricultural center, shipping grain and fruit up and down the Willamette. By 1900, there were 400 agricultural students on Corvallis, with a total population of about 2,000. With growth of the college, development of the city, and development with canals and locks on the Willamette Falls in 1873 from Army Corps engineers, the city of Corvallis would grow and eventually become the city it is today. Now, of course, there's a lot of history in between, but this is the overall start of the city.
And me being from Eugene, me, Phil Farrell, being from Eugene, you know, I didn't know too much about Corvallis history. So I was just interested. I was doing the research, learning along the way. And I'm sure there's some people out there that know a lot more. I'm sure there's people who know less, but I find this interesting. And hopefully one day I can do an interview with some actual Kalapuya tribe members. So hopefully, look forward to that one day. And if anybody is interested in that, in contact us at info@korcfm.com. But this does it for me, Phil Farrell, KORC News and Civics. Let's give him a quick little history lesson. So have a nice day and go out there and make some more history. Yeah.
This is a press release from the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife. titled Interior Department Establishes Willamette Valley Conservation Area in Oregon Conserving Vital Species Habitat, becomes fifth new unit in the National Wildlife Refuge System under the Biden-Harris administration from August 13, 2024. Corvallis, Oregon. The Department of Interior today announced the establishment of the Willamette Valley Conservation Area in Oregon as the 572nd unit of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service-managed National Wildlife Refuge System. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Martha Williams joined partners in Oregon today to celebrate the establishment. The new 600-acre parcel will provide crucial protected habitat for threatened and endangered species. This is the fifth new unit established under Secretary Deb Haaland's leadership in the 15th conservation area in the refuge system. The National Wildlife Refuge System plays an invaluable role in providing vital landscapes for wildlife species, offering outdoor recreation and bolstering climate resilience across the country, said Secretary Deb Haaland. In communities across the nation, the Biden-Harris administration is investing resources and bringing together local, state, tribal, and conservation partners to protect treasured outdoor spaces for current and future generations to enjoy. Today's announcement is the result of robust relationships that are coming together for the benefit of people and wildlife, said Director Martha Williams. It's because of these partnerships that today we celebrate the new Willamette Valley Conservation Area, which will help support Oregon's outdoor economy while protecting and restoring threatened and endangered species. Conservation areas are a type of national wildlife refuge that consists primarily or entirely of conservation easements on private lands. These conservation easements support private landowner efforts to protect important habitat for fish and wildlife and major migration corridors while helping to keep agricultural lands in production. Under the Biden-Harris administration, the service has added over 500,000 acres through willing seller land acquisition and approved the potential to acquire more than 1.6 million acres in fee, title, and easements across the refuge system. These efforts are locally supported and showcase a commitment to a collaborative and inclusive approach to conservation. Investing in and expanding the refuge system furthers the Biden-Harris administration's work to support the community-driven efforts and conserve and restore the nation's lands and waters through the America the Beautiful initiative. Located in the heart of the Willamette Valley between Salem and Eugene, the acquisition of the Diamond Hill Wetlands is the first purchase of the Willamette Valley Conservation Area. The 600-acre parcel just south of Brownsville, Oregon, is a step in a 10-year effort to permanently protect oak and prairie habitat for the benefit of five species listed under the Endangered Species Act, two candidate species, and numerous other plant and animal species of concern. The conservation area will also provide habitat for migratory waterfowl, shorebirds, neotropical songbirds, and iconic Oregon species such as the western monarch butterfly, the western meadowlark, and the Oregon white oak. The service worked closely with tribal nations, including the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Willamette Valley Oak and Prairie Cooperative, and private landowners to establish priorities for habitat management and land acquisition at the site. The establishment of the National Wildlife Refuge supports the cooperative's vision for protecting imperiled oak and prairie habitat and ODFW's Oregon Conservation Strategy. The Willamette Valley Conservation Area will be part of the Willamette Valley National Wildlife Refuge Complex, a group of national wildlife refuges managed predominantly to maintain winter habitat for dusky geese. In addition to the newly established conservation area, the Willamette Valley National Wildlife Refuge Complex consists of three refuges: William L. Finley National Wildlife Refuge, Ankeny National Wildlife Refuge, and the Basket Slough National Wildlife Refuge. In 2014, the service began working with local partners on a conservation study to analyze the landscape in the Willamette Valley and evaluate habitat most in need of protection. In 2017, the service published the Willamette Valley Conservation Study, which concluded that the amount and distribution of lands managed for sensitive native wildlife species in the valley was inadequate. The study specifically recommended the need for additional networks of grasslands, oak woodlands, and riparian habitat. In 2022, the service published draft plans, including an environmental assessment, and solicited public comments. In 2023, the service, in partnership with the Willamette Valley Oak and Prairie Cooperative, created the Willamette Valley Conservation Area and published a final land protection plan. This was a press release from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The following is from Jeff Tiedrich's Everyone is Entitled to My Own Opinion. The headline reads, "Convicted Felon Has a Solution to Crime. Just let the cops crack some skulls." The journalist H.L. Mencken once said, "For every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong." Donnie Convict heard that call, rolled up his sleeves, and got straight to work. He's devoted his whole life to coming up with the dumbest possible answers to the world's most complex problems. Hurricane in the Gulf? Just nuke the crap out of the effer. Boom! Problem gone. Drought in California? It's as plain as the nose on your face, pal. Just turn that big-ass imaginary faucet up in Canada and steal all their water. Pandemic killing thousands a day? Haven't you dummies ever heard of disinfectant? It kills germs, duh. And COVID is just a germ, right? So let's all inject Clorox into our veins. Booyah! Notre Dame's cathedral on fire? No prob, Bob. Send over some flying tankers to drop a blank ton of water on that puppy. You're welcome, France. Never mind the part where the weight of enough water to put out the fire would flatten the entire building. Faced with an imaginary crime wave? Well then, just let the cops go literally effing ape crap. Here's the quote. "The $950 is a misnomer because you can steal what you want. You can go away. But originally, you saw kids walk in with calculators. They would calculate. They didn't want to go over the $950. They're standing there with calculators, adding it up. You know, these are smart, smart people. They're not so stupid, but they have to be taught. Now, if you had one really violent day, like a guy like Mike Kelly, put him in charge. Congressman Kelly, put him in charge for one day. Mike, would you say right here, he's a great congressman. Would you say, Mike, if you were in charge, would you say, oh, please don't touch them. Don't touch them. Let them rob your store. Let them. All these stores go out of business, right? They don't pay rent. Then the city doesn't have it. The whole, it's a chain of events that's so bad. One rough hour, and I mean one real rough, the word will get out and it will end immediately." End of quote. Oh boy, here we go again with the fever swamp fairy tale about thieves with calculators who are allowed to steal up to $950. You'll be shocked to learn that it's not happening anywhere. The story has been completely debunked. But that hasn't stopped Donnie from telling it over and over. Now Donnie's come up with an answer, one that's clear, simple, and wrong. We should just let the cops bust heads. Boom! Problem solved in a day. Who gives a crap about civil rights? Am I right? All we need to do is let cops be judge, jury, and executioner, and super violent, and watch that problem disappear. Not just clear, simple, and wrong, but loud, brutal, and dumb. That's Donnie's brand. Hey, do you know where there was a solution where Donnie had every right to send in the cops to bust heads? You know what I'm talking about. Good old January 6th, when Donnie could have picked up the phone at any time and ordered the National Guard to restore order. But he didn't. He just sat there, glued to the TV, entertained by the chaos and destruction and loss of life that he had wrought. That's how Donnie reacted to actual crime. He sat on his ass and did jack squat. But when it comes to the non-existent problem of imaginary shoplifters with calculators, let the cops crack some skulls. And the cultists applaud and cheer because they're just as ignorant as Dear Leader. In fact, they're too dumb to realize when Dear Leader is bragging right to their faces about cheating them. Here's the quote. "I know a lot about overtime. I hated to give overtime. I hated it. I'd get other people. I shouldn't say this, but I'd get other people in. I wouldn't pay." End of quote. Hey, dummies, who do you think Dear Leader's talking about when he drones on about how much he loves to exploit workers? Here's a super fun story from New York's recent past. When the department store Bonwit Teller went out of business in 1979, Donnie bought the building with the plan of demolishing it and putting up that hideously ugly gold-plated tower that now stands in its place. The Bonwit Teller building was a New York landmark with Art Deco limestone bas reliefs. To quell public outrage over the demolition of a beloved landmark, Donnie promised to preserve the artworks and donate them to the Museum of Modern Art. Let's let an eyewitness describe what happened next. Here's the quote. "When I looked outside, I realized that a cluster of workmen were on a scaffold in the process of destroying the Art Deco limestone bas-relief with masonry saws and jackhammers. This piece of art and history being drilled to bits was destroyed right in front of my eyes. Suddenly, all the gallery goers in the room noticed too, going over to the large windows in disbelief as we watched the demolition in absolute helpless horror. The sculptures fell to the ground to crack into smithereens. Then someone in the room muttered loud enough for all to hear, 'That effing bastard!' No one had to ask who he was referring to. It was Donald Trump. Oh, and check this out." Trump initially avoided any comment about the Bonwit Teller artwork, but John Barron, a spokesman from the Trump Organization, contacted the New York Daily News to discuss the situation. Barron informed the Daily News that the, quote, "the merit of the stones was not great enough to justify the effort to save them," unquote. That was 44 years ago. We now know that John Barron was Donnie himself. Barron was an alias Donnie used when he phoned the tabloids, usually when he wanted to brag about his latest sexual exploits. Now let's let the workers that Mr. I Hate to Pay Overtime hired to destroy precious artworks. And here's a quote. "Donald J. Trump employed a crew of 200 undocumented Polish workers who worked in 12-hour shifts without gloves, hard hats, or masks to demolish the Bonwit Teller building on Fifth Avenue where the 58-story, golden-hued Trump Tower now stands. The workers were paid as little as $4 an hour for their dangerous labor, less than half the union wage, if they got paid at all." Donnie hired illegal aliens, quote-unquote, put them to work under unsafe conditions, and exploited the crap out of them. Did Donnie pay overtime? I don't even ask. But please tell me again how Donnie is a friend of the working class. It's such an amusing story. Donnie has a new excuse for the pathetically tiny crowds who are showing up to his hate rallies. It's all Joe effing Biden's fault. Here's the quote. "Wisconsin yesterday, and except for the fact that the administration would not let us have the people, we had 50,000, maybe more people, and we were going to do an outdoor rally. We ended up having to do it inside in front of 1,000 people, but we had 50,000 people that showed up. But they didn't want me to be outside. They said they couldn't get us enough people because we were guarding the United Nations and Iran. The president of Iran is here," unquote. Oh, boo effing who. No one said you had to rent a 1,000-seat hall. If you had 50,000 cultists waiting for you, why didn't you hold your hate rally in an arena? Hey, you know who never has to come up with excuses for small crowds? You know who is actually filling 10 to 18,000-seat arenas night after night? Of course you do. Kamala Harris. Hey, Donnie. Is it also Joe Biden's fault that bored worshipers stream out of your rallies in droves? Try to be less of a crushing bore, bro. Loud, brutal, and dumb. Only goes so far. That was a segment from Jeff Tiedrich's Everyone is Entitled to My Own Opinion. And you're listening to KORC.
This is Wendy Byrne bringing you details about your local government for KORC News, Music, and Civics. KORC strives to provide information from the City Council and other City of Corvallis boards and commissions during our news show. It is important for area residents to be involved in local government, and we understand that busy work and life schedules make that challenging. KORC News, Music, and Civics is here to help. Were you aware that Corvallis City Government follows specific state rules regarding city meetings? This includes providing public notice about meetings and allowing both live and remote attendance during meetings. Interested people can view meeting materials before or during the meetings, and these materials are archived after each meeting. More information can be found on the city's website at archives.corvallisoregon.gov. To make it easier to keep track of meeting dates and times, you can sign up to receive email notifications about various city meetings. Email notifications include details about the dates, times of the meetings, as well as links to the meeting materials. Sign up for notifications by going to the city website, corvallisoregon.gov. Once you are there, scroll down and find the e-notifications tab on the right-hand side of the page. This will take you to corvallisoregon.gov/subscribe. On this page of the website, you will see a comprehensive list of all the various advisory boards, commissions, task forces, and other meetings of the city that might interest you, and you can subscribe to receive email notifications about any of them. Once subscribed, you will receive email notices before the meetings and links to the recordings of the meetings when they become available. City of Corvallis meeting recordings are archived by chronological order on Vimeo. You can create a Vimeo account for free and use it to view these archives at vimeo.com/cityofcorvallis. For KORC, this has been Wendy Byrne. You can hear KORC News, Music, and Civics every Sunday at 1 p.m., repeated Mondays at 5 p.m., and archived at korcfm.com.